The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Well, the beginning of my talk is probably going to be a little bit depressing, but hopefully by the end of the talk it gets more uplifting. So to begin with, according to the CIA World Factbook, the world's population is believed to be just under 6.7 billion people. 3 billion people today, almost half the world's population, survives on less than $2 a day. Of these 6.7 billion, 6 million people, so, I'm sorry, 600 million people lack adequate shelter. 1.1 billion people, approximately one-sixth of the people on the Earth, have no access to drinkable water. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that 854 million people worldwide are undernourished. 300 million children go to bed hungry every day, and more than 90% of these children are suffering long-term malnourishment and nutrition deficiency. United Nations estimates that approximately 18,000 children die daily as direct or indirect consequence of malnutrition. People have actually been forced, and if you've been following coverage in Socialist Worker and ISR, see that there people are actually reaching new lows in order to survive. Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, where 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day, and the typical diet consists of 1,640 calories, which is actually 640 calories less than the average adult requirement. Haitians are being forced to eat clay patties to survive. It's a mixture of like black flour, actually made of yellow clay dirt. And in Burundi, people are trying to survive by eating a mixture of black flour and moldy shrubs. Somalis are trying to sustain themselves on a thin gruel made from mashed thorn tree branches. Just like stuff that I can't imagine eating. Most recently, as the world food inflation, world food inflation, protests have actually sparked in Egypt, Haiti, Mexico, Mogadishu, and elsewhere, basically demanding the right to eat. Even the president of the World Bank warned that 33 nations are at risk of social unrest because of the rising food prices. So his concern is social unrest. It isn't actually like, you know, making sure people eat. Food inflation, rising gas prices, and economic turmoil resulting from the subprime mortgage meltdown and other factors as well has put big questions back on the table for both those that control society and those that work for a living. The ruling class is eager to explain the current situation in a way that protects their power and wealth. And the working class is trying to figure out how to change their increasingly dire situation. From radio talk shows to internet blogs to newspaper editorials, liberal and conservative alike, one explanation that seems to have quite a serious following is that the food crisis stems from out-of-control population growth. There are just too many people to be fed. So when I was preparing for this talk, I was just skimming down the comments section of the New York Times editorial, actually the first one that popped up on my Google search. And the editorial is about the role of ethanol and the rising food prices. And I found the following comment. And there was a comment like this, maybe one every five, you know, throughout the comments section of the editorial. This is by Jeremy Bounce. As with all discussions of food supply, global warming, land degradation, etc., this editorial fails to even mention the only real issue underlying all these: limitless growth of the human population. Essentially, all environmental problems are proportional to the number of humans consuming resources and belching out chemical pollution. All these problems are insoluble without confronting the fact that there are far more people in the world than the world can support. Until all countries institute effective measures to lower the birth rate and gradually reduce the human population to sustainable levels, we will continue to destroy the planet at an ever-increasing rate until it becomes incapable of supporting any kind of life. Avoiding this issue is suicidal madness. So you hear kind of the argument. The argument is that the world is overpopulated or overcrowded, and that the pressures of population on the Earth's resources create the social problems that we see around us today, from poverty, global warming, to famine. This isn't actually a new argument. In fact, it was made popular by the essay on the principle of population in 1798 by political economist and actually cleric of the Church of England, Thomas Malthus. Malthus claimed to have discovered the law of nature, which explained poverty as natural and inevitable. He proposed the population, if unchecked, increases at a geometric rate, that is 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, etc., 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 whereas food supply only grows at an arithmetic rate, that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and etc., etc., etc. Poverty and starvation, therefore, were natural consequences of food production being unable to keep up with the population growth. Malthus never really proved this law scientifically, as many of his critics have pointed out, and historical data didn't actually support his claims either. So from where, according, did this law arise, according to Malthus? Malthus argued in his first essay, and I quote, "The supreme being, through the gracious designs of providence, ordained that population should increase faster than food." See, there you have it. You know, a scientist. Malthus argued that if left unrestricted, human populations continue to grow until they become too large to be supported by the food grown by available agricultural land, causing starvation, which then is a control on the population growth. Malthusian population theory has resurfaced over and over again since. And when I told my dad just nonchalantly that I was doing this talk, he said, "Oh yeah, when I was in school in the 60s and 70s, they were talking about overpopulation, same thing." So I kind of went and did some research about, you know, who might have my dad have heard talking about this, and I found a guy named Paul R. Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb in 1968 and The Limits to Growth in 1972. Where he predicted, and I like these predictions a lot, the population of the United States will shrink from 250 million to about 22.5 million before 1999 because of famine and global warming. Ehrlich also predicted that before 1985, mankind will enter into a genuine age of scarcity, in which the accessible supplies of many key minerals will be facing depletion. So those were predictions. I can think it's safe to say they weren't accurate. These ideas have actually, you know, been popularized, and I think they've crept into literature and television as well. In 1969, there was a Star Trek episode. I don't know if you guys watch Star Trek. I'm kind of putting my nerd credentials out there. So in the original series, there's an episode called "The Mark of the Gideon," which dealt with a race of overpopulated aliens who actually abducts Captain Kirk to try to solve their population problem. You know, and there's, you know, it's like overpopulation stuff is popular in science fiction and literature, and it just shows that this isn't like some kind of marginalized or something that's not really, that people haven't heard of. So you might be thinking, like, all right, what is this guy talking about? What, now he's talking about Star Trek. Where is he going with this? So, you know, I just wanted to kind of, you know, the point of this talk really is to show the social implications of the overpopulation argument. That the plague, you know, so-called plague of overpopulation has been used as a tool by the ruling class throughout history to advance its agenda at the expense of the working masses. Second, I want to argue that while sustainability is an important question for socialists, we cannot understand sustainability and overpopulation without first understanding the way things are produced under capitalism, and the corresponding way society under capitalism is divided into classes. Third, I want to argue that the current food and environmental crises are the result of capitalism, not overpopulation. And finally, I want to put forth some reforms that we can argue for today in the process of rebuilding a left in this country. But I also want to argue that ultimately socialism is a necessary step towards building a sustainable society. So the social implications of the population argument. Far from being fair and unbalanced, just like Fox News, Malthusianism arose from and was propelled forward by a ruling elite to justify their wealth, their power, and private property, ultimately. Anthropologist Eric Ross points out that among Malthus' principal aims was to explain the nature of poverty in a way that was not that not only would suggest that there was no viable alternative to the capitalist economy, but would also contribute to the evolution of that economy in a form of certain policy prescriptions, most notably the abolition of the poor laws, which at that time was the closest thing that existed to social welfare. So Malthus' argument was to absolve, actually, the emerging system of capitalism for any responsibility for the impoverishment of the masses. The blame instead was placed on the victims. Any public obligation to mitigate that misery, therefore, was fundamentally incompatible with the ultimate rights of property, since the form of social welfare, since any form of social welfare was bound to be a little more than a way of subsidizing the fertility of the poor at the expense of the well-to-do. You know, that was the logic. Thanks. In fact, Malthus argued that poverty, misery, disease, and famine were actually necessary to check overpopulation. Malthus argued that the hardships of poverty actually awaken Christian values missing from the poor. Socialist Friedrich Engels succinctly summed up the social implications of Malthusianism. It is always the poor who are the surplus, and nothing should be done for them except make their dying and starvation as easy as possible. You know, that's essentially what Malthus was saying. Malthusian thought presumes that the poor are not really the equals of the more privileged. It rationalizes poverty using the laws of nature, you know, supposed laws of nature. But you can also see what's implied here, that the poor innately lack middle-class virtues, such as prudence, foresight, and the capacity to manage their affairs in a rational manner. Throughout history, the Malthusian line of thinking has led down the road politically to justifying imperialism. And the line goes something like, you know, the problems of developing countries aren't the results of colonialization. It's not the results of the plundering of imperialist pirates. But instead, it's because the people in developing countries are irrational and uncultured. Malthus actually advanced these similar arguments to justify the English colonialization of Ireland. Specifically, you see that these arguments coming out around the potato famine. And if we follow this line of thinking, it's not hard to see how eugenics, you know, which is essentially trying to create a pure race through breeding, could flow from the Malthusian arguments of overpopulation. And to quote Eric Ross again, the anthropologist, eugenics was the next step in drawing the conclusion that that these moral deficiencies were innate, that the poor were inherently inferior to the well-to-do, and therefore incapable of manifesting such traits. The implication was no longer that the poor were a threat to social order simply because they were too numerous. They were dangerous on an even more fundamental level, because their excessive fertility was considered to be the cause of the deterioration of the nation's racial stock. I don't think people on the left or liberals should be accused of, you know, supporting eugenics. But I do think it's important that we point out, you know, the social implications of these arguments and really the history, the rotten history that Malthusian politics has had, you know, throughout history, and also its class nature. And I just want to give a couple more examples that are more contemporary. So overpopulation, I've never heard of this until I did the research, was used to justify the Cold War. It was argued that overpopulation and poverty was a breeding ground for communists, you know, and measures therefore had to be taken. Along with Reaganism, we heard of welfare queens were the reason for our economic hardships. The poor people were just having too many babies and draining the system. And finally, you know, most recently in the past couple of years, especially the Lou Dobbs and the right-wing populist rhetoric, we hear the overpopulation's arguments to criminalize immigrants. It's portrayed that immigrants are the reason that it's hard to find work in this country, that there's only so many jobs and immigrants are taking them all. Hopefully you can see the overpopulation argument isn't a friend of socialists, it's not a friend of the left, because it diverts attention from the system and actually scapegoats the most oppressed and marginalized that are struggling inside society. So what should our analysis be? Rather than poverty and environmental destruction flowing from overpopulation, socialists argue that these problems are the result of the way capitalism organizes production. In fact, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, authors of the Communist Manifesto, pointed out that capitalism creates for the first time the potential to eliminate poverty and hunger once and for all. Before capitalism, technology didn't actually exist to produce enough to meet the needs of the whole population. When people ran out of food, they packed up shop and they went somewhere else. When droughts hit, huge sections of the population were actually wiped out. But with the rise of capitalism, it's created a world market where each part of the world is dependent on each other. It has developed machine-based mass production, creating the productive forces that far surpass all previous societies. Marx and Engels identified this aspect of capitalism as actually quite progressive. So the problem isn't that capitalism can't produce enough to sustain its population. The problem is that production under capitalism takes place for profits, not for human need. What Marx called the means of production, that is the factories, the machinery, the tools, are controlled by a minority in our society, while the majority has to work for a living. In fact, Marx and Engels pointed out that the immense wealth of the ruling class is made on the backs of the exploited majority. Under capitalism, those that own the means of production, the ruling class, produce in competition with each other for profits. If one capitalist is not making out with as much profits as possible, they're probably they're losing out to another. So if you think about the Kmart, if Kmart isn't winning out, they're being gobbled up by Walmart. Profits are the driving force. Competition for profits is the logic that drives the system. And if minor details such as hunger, housing, protecting the environment get in the way, they're just, simply trampled. Human needs like food are treated just like any other commodity under capitalism. That is, their worth to the system is how much profit it actually produces for the rich. People are not considered to have the right to purchase any particular commodity. And no distinction is made in this respect between necessities and luxuries. Those who are rich can afford to purchase anything they want, while the poor are often not able to procure even their basic needs. Under capitalist relations, people have no right to an adequate diet, to shelter, or even medical attention. This country, 46 million people without health insurance. That's crazy. 46,000, 46 million, seems so high. So while overpopulation is really decried as the reason that people are starving, consider the following. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, with record grain harvests in 2007, there's more than enough food to feed everyone, at least 1.5 times the current demand. In fact, over the last 20 years, food production has risen steadily at over 2% a year, while the rate of population growth has actually dropped 1.14% a year. That's right. I mean, it's like that. Those are the statistics that I think are really crucial. The rate of food production has actually increased over the past 20 years, and the rate of population has actually decreased. Population is not outstripping food supply. The problem is that people under capitalism simply can't afford the very food that they need to survive. People under capitalism starve amid plenty. Take, for example, the New York Times article from a couple of years ago with the following headline. And the headline is, poor in India starve as surplus wheat rots. It's right there. Or the Wall Street Journal headline in 2004, want amid plenty, an Indian paradox, bumper harvests and rising hunger. So how can this be? How is it that we can have plenty of food while people are actually starving at the same time? Well, agribusinesses actually hoard food or destroy it to keep prices high. And believe it or not, governments actually pay subsidies with taxpayer money to agribusiness to not produce food. According to the Washington Post, $25 billion per year is paid by the U.S. government to agribusiness and individuals to effectively not feed the hungry. One of the starkest examples of this was painted during the Great Depression, while millions of poor and unemployed Americans went hungry. U.S. farmers were facing the exact opposite problem. They were producing too much food to keep prices from falling. So at the same time that millions of poor and unemployed people stood in bread lines for food assistance, food crops were being destroyed. And they're being destroyed because they couldn't make profit by giving it away. I don't know if you guys have read the classic Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, but he has this great quote, and actually I got this from Socialist Worker. Said, "The works of the roots of the vines, of the trees, must be destroyed to keep up the price. And this is the saddest, bitterest thing of all. Carloads of oranges dumped on the ground. The people came from miles to take the fruit, but this could not be. How could they buy oranges at 20 cents a dozen if they could drive out and pick them up? A million people hungry, needing the fruit, and kerosene sprayed over the Golden Mountains. There is a crime here that goes beyond denunciation. There is a sorrow here that weeping cannot symbolize. There is a failure here that topples all the success. The fertile earth, the straight tree rows, the sturdy trunks, and the ripe fruit, and children dying of pellagra must die because profit cannot be taken from an orange. And coroners must fill in the certificate, died of malnutrition, because the food must rot, must be forced to rot." Thanks. So as Marx and Engels characterize in the Communist Manifesto, corporations sit on top huge piles of profits and huge piles of wealth by sending the rest of us in a downward spiral to poverty. It shouldn't be a surprise then that the agriculture business has become the second most profitable business in the United States, second only to pharmaceuticals. We should consider the question of the environment, I think, in the same way as food, specifically the question of oil reserves, or the burning up of fossil fuels. At some point, clearly, the oil reserves will run out, and there's a serious debate taking place on whether we've reached peak oil production. But the fact of the matter is that there are other far less polluting technologies, such as water and hydrogen fuel system, as well as technologies that harness the sun, sea, and wind. But what prevents them from being used or are looked into is that oil and coal is extraction is extremely cheap right now. Energy companies are not interested in the massive retooling and investment a shift in energy resources will require. Not to mention the amount of capital that they have already sunk into exploration, extraction, and refining that they would be forced to write off. Existing forms of alternative energy, moreover, it's at this point not sufficient to meet our present needs. So there would have to be a huge investment in research and development, and that, of course, isn't profitable right now. So in The Drive of Profits, Marx and Engels describe another tendency of capitalism that I think is really important for us to consider when thinking about population. That's the tendency of capital to be concentrated and centralized in the hands of fewer and fewer capitalists. That is, as successful businesses run other smaller businesses under, they actually gobble up their wealth and in order to outcompete, capitalists purchase the latest technologies and machinery, enabling them to produce more and more with fewer and fewer hands. So these two aspects of capitalism, I think, kind of combined to create greater and greater unemployment. Marx and Engels called the unemployment the reserve army of labor. And they talked about how capitalism needs the unemployed and poverty to keep competition for jobs among workers really intense, try to push and pressure workers to accept lower and lower wages. And statistically, this trend is, I think, clearly illustrated by the unprecedented growth between the gap between the rich, super rich now, and the super poor. But I think this can be seen most devastatingly in developing countries where there's been huge migration of people out of the countryside to the cities. They leave the countryside because they have been forced off their land as giant agribusinesses have taken over. The small farmers move to the city seeking a better life, but they instead find a quite frankly, a hellish existence, life in slums with extremely high unemployment and underemployment. And if you guys have read Mike Davis's book, Planet of the Slums, he really describes this. How people are packed into handmade shacks like sardines, and he has a whole chapter about it's like called something like the Society of Shit, like where people are just like literally living in their own feces because there's no sewage system. So of the half of humanity who lives in cities, which is 3 billion people, 1 billion people, or 1/3 of city dwellers, now live in slums. just incredible. You know, it's a shocking statistic. When discussing the question of world poverty, especially in relation to the current food crisis, one cannot ignore the role of international financial institutions such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. Without getting into too much detail, because there's other talks on the current food crisis and other talks on world imperialism and stuff like that, I wanted to just kind of talk about and explain that the World Bank and the IMF they're actually tools of huge corporations, many of which being the United States, to extract wealth and profits from poor developing nations. The term neoliberalism is used to describe this, but really, I think the way we should conceptualize it is like the economic side of imperialism. When Marx and Engels pointed out that capitalism chases profits all around the globe, I think they describe this process accurately. Let me give you just one example from actually the current color edition of Socialist Worker. Actually, a great article in here. I forgot. The solution is the problem. Haiti, one of the countries hardest hit by the food crisis, used to grow its own rice, and Haitian farmers were protected by high tariff barriers. All that ended in 1986 when the International Monetary Fund, as a condition for more loans to pay off previous debt, forced Haiti to remove trade barriers. Within 2 years, domestic rice growing was decimated by cheap U.S. imports, leaving Haiti open to the vagaries of the world market and unable to feed its own population when prices shot through the roof. How can the U.S. companies afford to sell rice so cheaply that they can undercut competition in a country where 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day? Well, U.S. agribusiness is subsidized to such an extent that it can sell rice at up to 20% below the production cost, the very kind of support that Haitian farmers are actually barred from receiving. So you can see that by using the leverage of debt, these policies have gutted the economies of developing countries and pushed huge sections of the population off their land, funneling billions of dollars into the coffers of rich corporations here into the United States. The crisis is not a result of some iron law of nature, of overpopulation. It's the product of the laws that govern capitalism, that is, profits before people. One of the arguments that I think is popular on the left today is that overpopulation and sustainability is that average American workers and the culture of overconsumption is really the problem. That we're eating up the world's resources. And I think the real situation is actually much different. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 10% of U.S. households today are either at risk of or experiencing hunger. According to the American Second Harvest, which is the largest food bank in the United States, demand across the U.S. is up 15 to 20% over the last year, and many food banks are having difficulty coping. Actually, CBS News reported that more than 80% of food banks said they were unable to meet the rising need. In some places, applications for food stamps have doubled in the last year. According to federal statistics, in March alone, some 27.9 million Americans received food stamps. And that's actually up 1.5 million or 5.7% from a year earlier. With food stamps benefiting benefits averaging $1 per meal, many recipients find it hard, you know, as you can imagine, to make it stretch. The idea that Americans are fat and happy, I think, is just clearly false. Additionally, Heather Rogers, in a great book, we have the book here, Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, which everyone should read. It's excellent. Points out that the way products are consumed needs to be understood in relation to the way they're produced under capitalism. Workers don't need two or three cars, but actually capitalism does need workers to have two or three cars. She quotes a marketing consultant after World War II. Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing pace. So as a result, manufacturers design products to wear out faster than they need to through technological obsolescence, fashion obsolescence, or some kind of combination of the two. And durable items have been manufactured to be less durable to actually increase profits. Whole categories of profits have been created to be disposable right from the outset. Think of styrofoam plates or styrofoam cups. Thanks, I'm pretty getting there. And workers in the United States were actually had to be taught to accept disposability. It was not natural. The Society of Plastics Industry, a society for plastic industries, funded a massive public relations campaign to educate workers to shift their attitudes on the notions of waste. So they actually had to convince workers that they should throw things out. Another telling example is that U.S. workers did not choose to rely on gas-guzzling automobiles for transportation. In fact, Rockefeller Standard Oil joined General Motors, Firestone Tire, and Phillips Petroleum to form the National City Lines Holding Company, which bought out and actually dismantled more than 100 trolley systems in 45 cities between 1936 and 1950. Cities like Rochester, New York, where I'm from, have such pathetic public transportation now that most employers, when you go on interviews, one of the first questions they ask you is, do you have reliable transportation? Mm-hmm. And it's crazy. The buses are totally unreliable, and at the same time, we have these empty rail tunnels that weave throughout all of Rochester that now the only use is that homeless people use them for shelter. So, this is clearly not our fault. Capitalism is a chaotic system because it is driven by profits. In competition, capitalists are only concerned about the short-term profit. They do not consider the long-term effects that their decisions will have on the rest of society and later generations to come. And we've seen that when they do, they just don't care unless it challenges their power. In fact, I hope my talk has shown that their profits are made because the poor are starving. Capitalism, by its very nature, has alienated workers from nature. Workers have been ripped off the land and hoarded into giant cities, and now slums. And capitalism has created actually an antagonism between agriculture and industry where there should be cooperation. This rift needs to be healed. So what's the solution? How do we create a sustainable society? Well, many people propose individual solutions. I was outside our public library, and a woman told me that her solution was she's going to plant a vegetable garden, and she's going to stop eating anything with fructose syrup in it, fructose corn syrup. And I encourage people, to plant gardens and to recycle and carpool. But there's no individual solutions to what are systematic problems really rooted in the structure of capitalism. I want to quote Paul D'Amato, who wrote the book Meaning of Marxism, where he quotes Marx and Engels. What is required is nothing short of a revolutionary reconstitution of society, a complete revolution in the hitherto existing mode of production, and simultaneously a revolution in our whole contemporary social order. The point is not to leave nature alone, but to transform human social relations so that production and the technology accompanying it develops in a planned manner. Human need, and by extension, the care of the natural environment upon which human needs depend, must be central to that planning. Only by overcoming capitalism's contradiction between production and distribution, between planning and market blindness, and between classes, can all scientific knowledge that we have acquired be used in a completely conscious and rational way. So in short, we need socialism. We need workers to collectively seize the means of production and to make decisions collectively in the interest of the majority. Then profit can be taken out of the equation altogether. But honestly, revolution isn't on the agenda, in the next couple weeks. So what can we actually do today concretely? I just want to point out a couple things. First, I think we need to combat the overpopulation arguments that actually blame the victim. We should use the current period when the failures of neoliberalism are so clear for people to see to explain why capitalism, where profit rules, is an irrational way to organize society. So we have a role to play to actually win political arguments, or try to win political arguments at least, about the nature of the system and why the status quo can be changed. Secondly, we need to be proponents of collective action against the system. Take, for example, the struggle of Bolivia in 2000 against the privatization of the water system. Millions of Bolivian workers and peasants and poor people took this to the streets and actually forced the government to back down on its plan to hand the country's water system over to American-owned Bechtel Corporation. What is required now is a rebirth, really, of a global justice movement that can link arms in solidarity with the protesters around the developing world and raise the slogan that food is a human, fundamental human right. It demands that debt be dropped, the debts held by developing countries be dropped so that they can spend their money on feeding people instead of paying off capitalist loan sharks. Thanks. We need a global justice movement that recognizes capitalism has created the problem of hunger and is incapable of being part of that solution. We should continue to organize collectively against the war as well, the war in Iraq specifically. After all, the gasoline used by you and me in our cars pales in comparison to the fuel needed, you know, to fuel the tanks to occupy this country and to grease the wheels of grease the gears of airplanes and bombers and Apache helicopters. Furthermore, depleted uranium used in the United States weapons has spread through Iraq and created a toxic environment, resulting in high rates of birth defects, as well as what's being called the Gulf War Syndrome in returning veterans. And the occupation of Iraq has caused the largest refugee crisis, where people are like corralled into refugee camps, and this is where like overpopulation is really a problem. Lastly, and I'll just finish on this, we need to build, I think, a revolutionary organization of militants that can implant themselves into the struggles around. They can help to propel forward the movements as they develop. That can help people to see that capitalism is the problem and can articulate an alternative worth fighting for. And I think through doing this talk, you know, I've really, like, I see that I can see even more that this needs to be done. You know, it's like such a big and kind of stressful problem at certain times. But like one thing that we can do is like we have a room here, and that's like a starting point. We have 1,000, you know, serious activists at this conference this weekend, and that's a starting point. So like we got to continue to organize and continue to strengthen ourselves.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.